Today is the Sunday closest to Earth Day, and you may have noticed in our liturgies and our hymns and our scripture reading, and you will notice, I hope, in the sermon, a certain attention paid to the ways in which we are called by God to live as good stewards of creation, not apart from creation, but within creation. Now, last week when I preached, I preached to you while suffering from jet lag. The day before, on Saturday, Ann and I woke up in a hotel near Orly Airport outside of Paris. And that night, we went to bed here along the banks of Temescal Creek. And in between, I did a day's worth of work by writing a sermon and rereading significant portions of Lou Mudge's book, We Can Make the World a Sustainable Global Home, in preparation for an adult ed class I helped to lead before celebration. And in my sermon last week, I talked about how Ann and I, in a couple of different ways, encountered the ugly backlash against immigration that has taken hold in some parts of French society. And that worked for last week's sermon, but I would hate for anyone to get the impression that the only thing we saw in France was anti-immigration nastiness. In fact, both the people and the landscape of France are almost impossibly beautiful. You know this if you've been to France, that the food and the wine and the art and the dogs are well-behaved and perfectly groomed. And in France, even the bicycles are more beautiful than American bicycles. And in France, when people smoke cigarettes, it smells good. France is pretty wonderful. And one of the things that I love about France is how the older cities and towns and villages interact with the surrounding landscape. I saw this in parts of Paris, but more so I saw it in alpine villages of the Hauts-de-Bois where Anne and I were staying. We saw it in the towns of Burgundy as we passed by on the train making our way from Evian to Paris. Some of the newer towns and cities in France with their boring, boxy, drab apartment buildings look awkward and out of place. But the older places and buildings, to me, they look really well integrated into the world around them. And it's not just in France. Most of the older human settlements that I've seen do an amazing job of making the human communities look like they're part of the natural landscape. This is true on the islands of Scotland and just about everywhere in Italy and in Arab villages in Palestine, and Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Taos Pueblo in New Mexico, little towns of New England, and even some of the older towns and cities here in California. Now, there are modern examples, I think, of architecture and city planning that integrate human communities into the surrounding landscape. I think there are parts of Emeryville, for example, that achieve this. But it seems to me that the idea of folding human habitation into the natural world is a skill less common now than once it was. Of course, this is an observation that might charitably fit into the category of cowboy anthropology. But I suspect that one of the reasons more modern human settlements tend not to fit comfortably into the world around them is that at some point in the last 100 years or so, people started to believe that we humans aren't part of God's creation. We're not part of nature. We're certainly created by God, but we're special, we're different. And I suspect that modern buildings and towns and cities have been designed by people who considered the natural world to be a place set apart from human communities. I'm talking here about places like Cupertino and most of Sunnyvale, for example, which I hate to harp on Cupertino and Sunnyvale. Some of my best friends live in Cupertino and Sunnyvale. And I love me a really good Eichler house. But these communities seldom are walkable. They're designed so that the houses have great big garage doors out front, but no porches. And the people are directed inside, and there's little interaction with the landscape, as if the realm of nature and the realm of human community are irreconcilably separate. Nature, in this way of thinking, is a place you drive to discover. It's a place set apart a place to be enjoyed during one's leisure time and protected by our laws. And maybe a few people may live out in nature if you happen to work as a park ranger or a rancher. But for a lot of modern folk, the natural world has little to do with the towns and cities and neighborhoods where actual people live. I don't know how this happened, but I wonder if maybe it had to do with the Romantic movement in Europe. Poets like Wordsworth singing the praises of England's Lake District, and the Transcendentalist movement in the United States, which sent people like Henry David Thoreau out to places like Walden Pond to live in nature, which had the effect of dividing the world up into nature and into the places where people live. Now, I admire the Romantics, and Thoreau is one of my ideological heroes, but I think this is an unhealthy way to divide up the world. This is not necessarily to say that I think we should fill up Yosemite Valley with tastefully designed townhouses, but rather, I think we need to acknowledge that God's creation, nature, isn't just off in the woods or in the mountains or in places where John Muir might find inspiration. Rather, God's creation is all around us. Even if we live in a bland suburb or a gritty urban core. The Russian novelist Leo Tolstoy made this observation in the opening paragraphs of his final novel, a book called Resurrection. Tolstoy wrote, "Though men in their hundreds of thousands had tried their hardest to disfigure that little corner of the earth where they had crowded themselves together, paving the ground with stones so that nothing could grow, weeding out every blade of vegetation, filling the air with the fumes of coal and gas, cutting down the trees and driving away every beast and bird, still, spring was spring, even in the town. The sun shone warm, the grass, wherever it had not been scraped away, revived and showed green, not only in the narrow strips of lawn and the boulevards, but between the paving stones as well. And the birches, the poplars, and the wild cherry trees were unfolding their sticky, fragrant leaves, and the swelling buds were bursting on the lime trees, and the jackdaws and the sparrows and the pigeons were cheerfully getting their nests ready for the spring, and the flies, warmed by the sunshine, buzzed gaily along the walls. All were happy, plants, birds, insects, and children." And I think this message also is present for us in the wisdom of Genesis' first chapter, when God creates humans not set apart from creation, but as integrated into it. Integrated into the world God was speaking into existence. According to the sacred story, we were created in God's image and given the responsibility of caring for creation, but not as people living outside of what God was creating, but as creatures woven into the fabric of God's universe. What this means is that the health of human communities and the health of creation is not just connected. It's not just two links in a chain or two sides of a coin, but the health of human communities and the health of creation really is the same thing. And I've probably told you this before, but I grew up in a place where the local economy was like a table supported by four legs. In the Mendocino of my childhood, there was logging and salmon and fishing and tourism and marijuana. Logging, salmon, fishing, tourism, and marijuana. When I was a kid, both the logging and the fishing industries were sustainable. Tourists were welcome guests, and pot was an option for those willing to take the risk. But then in the late 80s and the early 90s, the logging industry was bought out by out-of-state companies who wanted to extract as much of the timber wealth as quickly as possible. Suddenly, one leg in our economic table stopped being sustainable. And the logging binge ruined the salmon spawning grounds and streams inland, which ruined the fisheries, and now there are just two legs left in the table. These days, tourists aren't just welcome visitors. They're a necessary commodity in my hometown, which is dehumanizing. And for a lot of folks, marijuana production is the only option if you want to have a middle-class income. And it's not just jobs that were lost. A whole culture, a local way of life with stories and traditions and flavors and linguistic quirks and place-specific knowledge is dying because somewhere along the way, people forgot that human communities and economies and cultures are integral parts of the creation that surrounds them. Borrowing ideas from Lou Mudge's book that some of us have been looking at on Sunday morning here, the problem, it seems, is that the folks running the timber industry didn't stop to consider the fact that salmon had a stake in the decisions they made relative to how many trees should be felled. And so did mill workers and the fishers, whose children now must choose between cultivating pot, with all of the risk that entails, or working part-time for minimum wage in a bed and breakfast, or moving out of the area to find a job. This is an economic reality that is happening all over our country and indeed all over the world. Folks who make business decisions forget that human communities, like any number of species of flora and fauna and forests and watersheds that support them, they're all woven into the same fabric as the places that might be destroyed by their business models. And sometimes those places destroyed by business models can be far from where the business is happening, but it makes them no less connected. Consider, for example, the coal that is extracted from Utah and sent by way of perhaps the proposed coal export terminal in Oakland to Asia, where it is burned to generate electricity. The destruction of a mountain in Utah, and therefore the destruction of local communities in Utah, is bad enough. But the coal extracted in Utah also pollutes and causes health problems in the communities like Oakland, through which the coal is shipped on open rail cars. And then, when it is burned in power plants in, say, China, the pollution causes respiratory problems for local population, and the carbon emitted makes significant contributions to global warming, which is melting the glaciers in the Tibetan Plateau, glaciers that feed the major rivers in Asia and support all the watersheds, and support the watersheds in which something like a third of humanity lives in more than a dozen countries, at least three of which have nuclear weapons. And when the glaciers melt, the wars will start as regional powers grapple over dwindling water resources. And when that happens, we're all losers. All of which is to say we are all connected. We're all part of the same earth, all part of the same human family, which is part of the same creation that is inhabited by fish and mammals and flowers and trees and rivers and mountains. We're all part of the same system that is God's creation. Billions of people, to say nothing of untold numbers of plants and animals and glaciers and rivers and mountains, all have a stake in whether or not people in Utah decide to extract coal from the ground and ship it through Oakland to China. This is why I'm encouraged by the work that Rabbi Michael Lerner is doing with the Network of Spiritual Progressives in promoting an environmental and social responsibility amendment to the Constitution. The idea behind what's called the ESRA is to require businesses to consider the broader impact of decisions they make. How do our decisions affect the environment? And can we establish a new bottom line so that success is not measured in terms of numbers on a spreadsheet, but by the well-being that our industries and our enterprises promote? And I would say that it's not just the business community that needs to be asking these questions. Every day, each one of us makes choices that affect God's creation and the people and the communities that are part of God's creation. It may be faster and a little cheaper to drive instead of taking the bus. It may be less expensive and more convenient to buy stuff online rather than spending time in an actual store. It may be hard to get out to the farmer's market when veggies can be bought shrink-wrapped in plastic at Trader Joe's. But which decisions are better for the earth? Which decisions are better for the communities, both locally and around the world, who have a stake in our decisions? It's not just logging companies and energy companies whose decisions affect the world in which we are all connected by a mutual belonging. But all of us touch and change the earth, and it can be in destructive ways, or we can take a lesson from those who built the towns and villages and cities in France that I love so much and find so charming. We can live lives that interact positively and beautifully with the world around us. We can see our lives as being part of and not distinct from nature. And when we do, not only will God's creation thrive, but we will be living as we were created to live. And we will, as a result, find great joy.